The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I'm excited to welcome our guest this evening. In 1990, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Les Payne set out on a nearly 30-year quest to write the most comprehensive biography of Malcolm X ever attempted. Through painstaking research and exhaustive interviews, he sought to separate fact from fiction in order to offer a revelatory and wholly new portrait of this uniquely American icon. Les Payne was a former editor at Newsday, syndicated columnist, and a founder of the National Association of Black Journalists. Sadly, he passed away in 2018, just before completing his opus. His daughter and principal researcher, Tamara Payne, who's with us tonight, completed the work, which has since become a finalist for the 2020 National Book Award. We wish them well next week. In his New York Times review of the book, Wellesley Dean and Professor Michael Jeffries writes, "Malcolm's presence is beautifully rendered, but the dead or arising is not a tribute or enshrinement of achievements. Instead, it reconstructs the conditions and key moments of Malcolm's life, thanks to hundreds of original interviews with his family, friends, colleagues, and adversaries. Nobody has written a more poetic account." Tonight, Tamara Payne will be in conversation with Sarah Glover, veteran journalist and past president of the National Association of Black Journalists. Tamara and Sarah, the screen is all yours.
Thank you. Good evening.
Thank you.
We appreciate the Free Library of Philadelphia welcoming both of us to talk about one of the most important figures in American history. And I'm so honored and delighted to have this conversation with Tamara Payne about the amazing work that her and her father undertook for 3+ decades. In the book title, which we're going to have a great discussion tonight about, is The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X. What an amazing concept to unpack, this amazing figure in our history. And you know, I wanted to jump in with Tamara, but I wanted to also just take a moment to thank all of you for tuning in to this discussion, because it shows the level of interest in this work, shows how important the discussion of Black figures in history are. And, you know, the fact that Les Payne took the time to really do the work that it takes. And I think that level of commitment, 3 decades, speaks to the commitment that we all should have today on telling rich and authentic stories of the Black experience in America, to restrain ourselves, whether you're a journalist, a marketer, a lawyer, whatever field you work in, to restrain yourself from falling, you know, a fool to stereotypes and falling a fool to common narratives, but to really find the story, unpack the narrative, and tell the true story. And isn't that fitting in a year like 2020, where you know, social inequity and racial justice is at the forefront? It's a competing, dueling pandemic that we're dealing with in addition to the coronavirus. And so I wanted to share with you all that Tamara is a dear friend. Her family, Mrs. Violet Payne, Jamal Payne, the other one of the brothers, and Hiley Payne, another brother. So wanted to acknowledge the family and their commitment and their amazing bond is a subset of this phenomenal book that we're going to get into, that the family is, you know, and strong narratives and strong journalism comes from a foundation. And so like every good journalist, there are people around that journalist that make not just the work possible because there's a life-work balance, but in this instance, contributed to this amazing body of work. And I look forward, Tamara, to discussing how you contributed from the beginning as a researcher. And but we have to start with talking about your dad just briefly. And your dad, Les Payne, I want to hear from you about who he was and what type of impact that he had on you, not only just in creating this body of work, but who he was as a journalist and as a man.
Les Payne, I would say, is probably one of the most underrated journalists from the last half of the 20th century, certainly the last quarter. He practiced in pretty much every role as a journalist, from start with just local reporting, national reporting, to foreign journalism, to editing and managing, you know, his staffs and budgeting and different desks at all at Newsday, Long Island newspaper. But the other thing I always like to explain about that is that my father lived through so many eras of this country. He was born in Jim Crow South in Alabama, and his family moved up to Hartford, Connecticut. So where you're experiencing integration, but there's still problems with racism there. And went to school and then also went into the Army. And again, the reason why you're going into the Army, it's even dealing with what are the opportunities that are there for Black people other than serving in the military at that time. This was in the 1960s. So Dad served in the Army. He worked under General Westmoreland in Vietnam. And he was a speechwriter, and he also managed the Army newspaper under General Westmoreland. But one of the experiences that Dad had under there was that he met a reporter who worked for the Washington Post at the time. He was writing a series about the Vietnam War and what's going on with the troops. And Dad took him around on their fort in Vietnam and showed him different things. And there was a story that this reporter wrote, his name was Jesse Lewis, who wrote a series, this was in 1963. And he said that the troops were flying the Confederate flag. And this was in the Washington Post, and the president of the country of the United States read that and was very upset. And he called General Westmoreland at 3 o'clock in the morning and chewed him out and said, "You can't do this, and you have to take those flags down." And because this was an embarrassment, because the Confederate flag was not the recognized flag of the United States, and certainly not of the United States Army. And so they were forced to take that down. And what Dad felt was, what he learned from that experience, was the importance of journalism and the power of journalism. He said, what he learned was of the power of revealed facts reported by a free press, protected by the Constitution, which is determined to inform the public about what is going on. And that's important because that means that the public will, with this information, can make informed decisions. And when you don't have that information, we've seen that over the years in other countries that don't have a free press, what happens. But now we're also experiencing that here too, with the different issues and the information disinformation campaigns that have been going on. So, but that was what drew Dad to journalism and the power of journalism. And he believed that he could use that to help change people's predicament and their minds and affect change in this country, particularly for Black people. And so that was his commitment, that he was a journalist to the core. Fast forward to, you know, he's working his career. He covers very important stories, such as the migrant workers on Long Island, the heroin trail, which is in the 70s, the heroin was the drug of choice and it was killing people. And that became a huge story in which he looked at heroin and how it was a business. It started growing in the poppy fields in Turkey and went through the French Connection, coming back to the United States. And he worked on a team of reporters and they won a Pulitzer Prize for the coverage of that trail. And then he also uncovered the kidnappers of Patty Hearst, the publishing heiress in the 1970s, and what that was about. And so these are important stories. And then other important stories he worked on were stories in Africa in particular, and Haiti and Jamaica. But what he's really known is for his reporting on the Soweto uprising in South Africa. And these are important stories that of the 20th century that a lot of people, you know, getting information about how these incidents are happening, what the real story was, help frame people's minds and making informed decisions about how they live their lives. So he operated at that level throughout his career. And then when you fast forward to wanting to write this book, as a journalist, Dad wanted to, he was a storyteller and he was always looking for the story. What does that mean? What's new here? What's not known? And how will this affect how people will take this in? And that's how and that's the only way he really knew how to tell a story. And that's how he applied in the writing of this work.
Well, thank you, Tamara, for that overview. And so just to again thank the folks that are with us this evening for this discussion, you are free to at any time put questions you may have into the chat. Into the Q&A portion of the chat, and we will get to questions later in our discussion. On top of the overview of Les's career and how Les was a global, had global impact in his storytelling. I'm honored to call him a mentor and someone that I look up to as a young journalist and obviously as a member of the National Association of Black Journalists, him being a former president and a founder, and one of literally only a few of our esteemed founders hold that distinction. Dwayne Wickham, Vernon Jarrett, very, very few have that distinction. And Les literally is a journalist who, he managed his career, and I say managed it, because it wasn't managing it. He embodied excellence throughout. And why tonight, of course, we're having this conversation, he's not present, is because he has passed. Sadly, in 2018, he has passed. But yet his legacy it lives on in me. It lives on in Tamara and all of his children and all of the people that he's touched, not just in the writing of his stories, but the number of people he has developed careers. He has impacted the careers of thousands of journalists, and not just Black journalists and communicators, but journalists of all walks of life. And that is a tremendous impact. And the lesson that we can take away from this book is that commitment to have been working on this story for three decades. And we're gonna get into some of the work, the actual work that was done. This is what makes this book unique. This is a book that next week we'll find out about the National Book Awards, and we're all excited about all those awards down the road that Mayor see to give the credit where it's due here. But we're going to unpack it and talk about just how compelling this work is. And Tamara, I'd like you to talk about that 30-year journey and what that was like. And you were a young cub when this all started, and you guys started this work. Talk to us a little bit about how your dad, Mr. Payne, decided to take on this assignment, and what were some of those first interviews or first strategies, and how do you start this big project, to tell the story of Malcolm X? Tell us how it all started.
Great. Thank you, Sarah. That was a great question. And I just want to make one correction. I said 1963 was when Dad was in Vietnam. With that story, it was 1967. So my apologies on that. I'm going to be bad with dates, so forgive me. So starting the story. Dad was, he had a friend, Walter Evans, who was a surgeon in Detroit, who was treating one of Malcolm's brothers. And he encouraged my dad to come and meet this brother. And this is Filbert, who was Malcolm's older brother by a couple of years. And Dad met him and talked with him for about 8 hours. He was fascinated by what Filbert shared with him about their childhood, growing up, their family life, their parents, the other siblings, what that was like. And also a little bit even more about his relationship with Malcolm. And, when Dad went into this, he didn't want or think about writing a story about Malcolm, writing a book about Malcolm. He would write about him in his columns, at least once a year around his birthday and a couple other times when the news story merited it, but he didn't think it was necessary to write a biography of Malcolm because he felt that the autobiography sufficed and that his speeches were great, and that's all we needed. But what he learned was that we don't know about who that person was when they were a child and how they became the person that we've come to know as Malcolm X, or even El Hajj Malik Shabazz. So he comes back to New York, he meets another good friend of his, Gil Noble, who's also a journalist, has a show here in New York called Like It Is, which is very important. And he talks to him about meeting Malcolm. They both admire, both my father and Gil admire Malcolm, and they talked about this stuff, among other things. And Gil said, which brother did you meet? You should meet Wilfred. That's the one you should speak to. So Dad said, okay. And he goes back to Michigan, finds that he's still there. And he gets an introduction and he meets with Wilfred, who's open to talking with my father. And unfolds this whole other side of the story as the elder. He is 6 years older than Malcolm. So there are things that he remembers about Malcolm, as opposed to Filbert, who was 2 years older than Malcolm. So it's a different perspective. And also he was Malcolm's best friend. So with these 2 8-hour plus interviews, Dad was processing what he learned about somebody he admired a lot, and he couldn't let it go. And at that time, I was finishing up my stint in China. I was an English teacher, and I came home to visit for the holidays and at the end of 1990. And, you know, he just couldn't let go of these discussions, these conversations, these interviews. And he kept processing and processing. And finally, he said, you know, Malcolm's presented to us fully formed. We don't know, you know, who he really is. He's like, we don't know his family. We don't know anything about him. And so he says, you know, it's time to learn about who Malcolm really is. And so what his whole motivation was to talk about Malcolm in his family and what his lineage is about and his background and his foundation, but also to talk about the world Malcolm was born into. Because he's presented to us in a vacuum as fully formed and angry, but nobody really talks about the context of what that anger was in response to. And so Dad took that opportunity to do it his way as a journalist and to incorporate all of his interests. And I'm telling you, all of his interests, not me, writing, editing, interviewing, meeting these different people. His focus on this was just incredible. And he did this while being an assistant managing editor at Newsday, managing other reporters, and sometimes even coming out of retirement and reporting on some stories of his own, and writing a syndicated column, as well as appearing on Sunday Edition here in New York every week. And everybody would talk about these. So he was known, he was popular. It wasn't like nobody didn't know who Dad is. Everybody, they enjoyed talking with Dad. People enjoyed working with him. And so we weren't working on this full time, but we were working on this. And we were taking our time to learn. And also at that time, Malcolm was in the air. This is in 1990s. So 1991 and two, you know, Malcolm's in the air. Young people are talking about him loudly. Rappers are using him in their lyrics and their songs. So he's in the air, he's popular. And then, you know, I will say, even as we're doing this work over the years, you know, questions would come up. Okay, well, if you get it out now, you're going to get it out in time with Spike Lee's film. Or if you get it out now, you're getting out in time with these other kind of milestones. And we're like, yeah, but this story's going to come out when it's ready. Who's to say that our story isn't going to create its own moment in time? So, and that's how we focused. And we just focused on us doing the work. We couldn't focus on what everybody else was doing. We did go see Malcolm's, the Malcolm movie that Spike Lee did. And we were encouraged and excited by the excitement of that. And that's important to have that. But Malcolm's name was in discussion in the 90s and later. And actually, he never left the scene, to be honest, after he was assassinated. So I came in at the beginning. I was there when Dad decided to write the book. And when I came back from China, you know, Dad was saying that, okay, I'm going to work on this. And I was still trying to figure out, well, there are things I want to go to graduate school. There were other things I wanted to do. I put graduate school on hold. This became my graduate education on steroids. And I didn't know it was going to take 30 years, but I just knew that this story was important, especially working with my father, because seeing my father, knowing what my father has done, he's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. How often do you get to work side by side with a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, who let alone is your father? He's a masterful editor. How often do you get to do that and have these kinds of conversations with them? So I really was looking forward to learning from him, and he was happy to pass the skills on to me. But also we, as father and daughter, you know, we shared the information. We talked about everything. He shared everything with me about how he saw the book, how it changed over time. In the beginning, it was all about getting as much information as we could obtain. Meeting people. I mean, I started off going to scouring libraries, whatever library, starting in the New York Public Libraries, not just the Schomburg, the main library, you know, and then going to universities, finding out where people's papers were located, for example. Going to places where I knew that Malcolm's family was and saying, I want to go check the local newspapers to see what kind of articles were written around the time Malcolm died, maybe while they were alive. Anything. It was all about vacuuming all that information. I went to the National Archives. I even went into the FBI. That was a really interesting experience to go to their headquarters to look through their files that were at the which they had opened up. And that was really exciting, you know. But the other thing that was exciting was watching Dad prepare, do his job really of real reporting, like preparing for interviews. Special skill for that. You know, and I got to help him do that. I got to even frame some of the questions and the directions of some of those interviews. But more importantly, I also got to, I also transcribed a lot of them, not all of them, but I transcribed a lot of these interviews. So I knew I was very much involved with all of these, you know, wherever we were going with this story. And we were just in constant communication about this. And with us being, you know, father, daughter, we already had a good relationship. It got deeper over the years.
Tell me something that you discovered about Malcolm X's personality while researching him, talking with friends, relatives, any text or data source that you can think of. But explain what his personality was like from this research and work you guys have done, and how did that surface, or how did you come to know and learn something new about his personality? Because I liked how you framed your discussion, and really is the central part of this work, is that you and your father really identified and saw that in fact we don't have a good telling of the building up of this individual over the course of the journey of a life, and what formed his opinions and what formed his perspective. That had not happened in the great detail until this work. So what did you learn, and how would you summarize elements of his personality, whether at any point in his period of time or life, or something that we don't know about that early stages of his life and how that formed the person that he became?
He was always described as smart and intelligent, a quick learner. But all the siblings were smart, by the way. They were all fast, very quick learners. And he was always smart. Wilfred said he had a very high IQ, but I'm sure all of the siblings did, because they were all very intelligent people. I actually got to speak with Wilfred, you know, once, and he's an amazing person. But the thing that kind of stuck out to me was his need for attention. And that kind of comes up a bit in this book. Malcolm liked to be the center of attention, and that can, you know, transpire in different ways. You know, always want to make people laugh, always want to have everybody have the focusing on you, so you may just do things to shock people, to make them focus on you all the time, or you're being funny. And Malcolm had a bit of that, but he also, it after his father had died, it kind of went to this direction of the more negative thing of trying to get attention because he missed his father. He was close to his father. And I'm kind of jumping a little bit ahead, but that personality thing of needing to be a center of attention when he was younger, it kind of, you know, starts his activities for getting this attention is what brings him to the attention of the police, for example, in Lansing. And that's, you know, that's not the good side of it. But I think that he actually uses this to his advantage as he grows older, using this attention during his hustling days, which were still where he was still a teenager. But even when he, earlier days, when he's in the Nation of Islam, how he masters and studies the media. The television is becoming the main form of media at the time, like the internet is today. And we see how young people have taken on and mastered the internet to their abilities. Malcolm was doing much the same thing with the television and how he was able, it was not Elijah Muhammad that brought the television to the Nation of Islam, it was Malcolm. He got the media attention really to the Nation of Islam and what they were doing and being, you know, and so this, it grows, it morphs, it's how he masks. He's not a shrinking violet, he's not shy, but he does end up using it for good. So I wouldn't say that that's negative, but it was an interesting thing to learn that, you know, in the process of working on this book. And there are other things, like, of course, he was tenacious, he was focused, he was disciplined. People may like to argue that in his younger days he wasn't, but who's really, you know, focused and disciplined when they're 10 and 12 years old? But when he comes out of jail in particular, he wants to pivot. And, you know, and his family is already in kind of in the Nation of Islam, and that provides him a landing place to be. But the other thing that's important that I was also fascinated by was the presence of his family at every stage of his life. They were always there. We don't always know that. A lot of people may not have known that Wilfred and Filbert and Hilda and Yvonne were always around, and Reginald and Wesley, you know, and even Robert, who was the baby. Yeah. They may not know all these names and what they, and even Ella. I mean, Ella, we'd hear more about, but they were kind of quiet, but they were, again, living their lives, but doing their thing. They were very capable people too. I'd like to read a little bit from the book to talk about his upbringing. And this is gonna be about his parents, really. One is gonna be about the first one I wanna read is about his mother and her conditioning of her children to be as Black people living in Lansing.
And this share with page you're on, so if anyone has the book, they can open up.
This is page 73. It's The Anchor is Lost. And I'm gonna start at the bottom. The story of Little Black Samba, published in 1899 by the British writer Helen Bannerman, was a standard children's reader at Pleasant Grove. The illustrations of the dark Indian child caused derisive snickering among whites, but the Pickaninny slur, along with the unrestrained banding about of the term nigger, repulsed the little children, who were taught at home to disparage such put-downs of the Black race. As the taunts escalated, it was their mother, Louise, who conditioned Malcolm and his siblings not to overreact to the racial slurs. "We didn't like being called a nigger," Wilfred said, but we would try to downplay it. "My mother always told us that you can handle racial slurs in a way where you make them continue, or you can let them think they're not hurting you." She would give an example. "If you're throwing darts at a dartboard, there's a satisfaction you get when you hit the target. When you miss it, you get another feeling." "Well," she said, "it's the same with white people. When they're throwing darts at you by the things they say and do, but if they don't hit the target, then they won't get the satisfaction, and eventually they'll quit. And usually that's the way it worked." This psychological training for the resistance of racial provocation was conditioned into the behavior of young Malcolm and his siblings. Their behavior earned grudging respect among growing numbers of whites in their neighborhood, despite, and in some cases because of, their adherence to Garveyism. And then there's another piece I wanted to read to talk a little bit about their father. This is also in The Anchor is Lost. It's on page 79. All the children agreed that even though their father was not as given to education as their mother, Reverend Little was dead set on instilling a work ethic, and that as a preacher, organizer, he possessed a sharp ear for glibness. In this latter case, he likely had a penchant for young Malcolm's gift for expressing himself verbally and otherwise. Earl would take young Malcolm with him on proselytizing trips for Marcus Garvey. It was only me that our father would take to the UNIA meetings, which he held in quietly in different people's homes. Malcolm noted in the autobiography, this special and primal paternal bond was the enduring essence of Malcolm's childhood in printing. Even before he reached the first grade, he was impressed with the potency of leadership as demonstrated by his father at these UNIA meetings. I remember seeing big shiny photographs of Marcus Garvey that were passed around from hand to hand, Malcolm wrote. Despite Garvey's imprisonment and deportation, Reverend Little was highly respected as a regional UNIA president. And Malcolm recalls his father closing the house meetings with two dozen or so followers by chanting, "Up you mighty race, you can accomplish what you will."
Beautifully said, beautifully said. I'd like to take us now to a question about what we will learn with this book. What do we learn? Can you share one gem in the book? You know, I love that this is it's an impressive piece of work. I just want to hold it up. I was fortunate to get a printed copy, but the visual cover is something that I'm extraordinarily excited about and impressed with. Love the portrait of Malcolm and the other images inside the book. Love the choice. Talking about the book itself, what is something in this book that maybe we have not heard about Malcolm, or some gem that this book helps us learn more about, if you want to share?
I think that we get a lot more nuanced details and vision, perspective of Malcolm, who he is and his relationship with his surroundings, his family, and people who worked with him. One of the things that I really was excited about, my father was excited about because he grew up in Hartford, was learning that Malcolm was the organizer, actually, of the temple in Hartford. That was temple number, I'm not even gonna say what temple number was because I'll probably get it messed up right now because I'm nervous. But the Hartford temple was important in that sense that he was invited by a woman who lived in Hartford and was encouraged by the Nation of Islam and what they were saying. And she knew who Malcolm was and invited him to speak to a group of her friends and family. And he went, and you know, they were really enthusiastic. He worked with them. They started a temple, they got a building. He worked with the men and encouraging them about building up their businesses, getting jobs, being self-sufficient, and also being independent. And he really encouraged them not to accept welfare or accept unemployment even. He said, get a job. So these are things that we kind of know about, but it's like, this is confirmed by actually people who were there on the scene. The other thing I want to bring up is that, I mean, we do know that Mark, you know, his parents were Garveyites. They were members of the Universal Negro Improvement Association. His father was a president he was an organizer. And when they moved out to the Midwest, that's what they were doing. He was organizing black families in places that they were not organized in, and he was working with them and doing that. And then after he would get them going, he would kind of move to another place. And so it's important to understand that this Garveyism is the Marcus Garvey is a through line. Garveyism and what he was promoting is a through line in the family. The family never veered from that. Malcolm also really doesn't veer from that. It always comes up. And you know, and it's important to understand that. The other thing is, as you were talking about the cover of the of the book. That picture was taken in 1963. This is the building behind it, is the Capitol building in Hartford. And this was the year my father actually saw Malcolm at Bushnell Memorial. And so it's important. When I found this picture and was able to work with it for the book, I said, this is the picture because Hartford's important to us. We have family there. My father grew up there. His friend Walter Evans, who's one of his best friends, also grew up there, and who introduced him to Filbert as well as Wilfred. So it was really exciting for me to be able to get this photograph and get it to work to make it work for this for the cover of this book. And because Dad's not here, it shows this is for Dad too, because this was where he grew up. He considered Hartford home.
Thank you for making that connection. Tonight, there are numerous folks participating from the city of Philadelphia as this book discussion is in partnership and powered by the Free Library of Philadelphia. So go Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love and sisterly affection. Of course, we see there are many people tuned in from all over the country and even the world. So we welcome everyone to the discussion. If you have questions, feel free to put them in the Q&A section and I will get to them just in a few moments. But I wanted to mention Philadelphia one more time. And I mentioned this with you, Tamar, in a conversation that Malcolm did come to Philadelphia. Could you talk just briefly about his connection to Philadelphia? This is just a fun fact that I wanted to include in our discussion.
I mean, Philadelphia is important in the sense that it was one of the early temples that he helped to organize. He didn't start it. It was already in existence. What happened was in the 1961, maybe 59. Okay, getting the dates mixed up here, I'm sure. But he had left, this is the end of 50s, actually. He had left Detroit. You know, he kind of had a falling out with the membership in Detroit because he was very strict. He was very enthusiastic, and he was also pursuing outside of the blue collar groupings that was already kind of filling up the membership. So he was pursuing, college educated people, black people who into the membership. And that was a different, and it caused strife and stress. And the people who were members there kind of had issues with that. So what happened was he kind of fell out with the membership in the sense that they felt, one, he was too strict. He was bringing these people, they were starting rumors, and he got sat down because Elijah Muhammad was saying, you're not relating to the people. You have to relate to the people. And Malcolm was like, I just want this to grow. This is so important. Everybody needs to be a part of it. So his enthusiasm, I mean, Elijah Muhammad wasn't going to kick him out. He realized the potential here. So he sent them off to the Northeast and said, pick your temple. So he started in Boston, but also ended up, you know, because again, he's very ambitious. He started, you know, exploring and seeing where the other temples were and seeing where the issues were and just moving into, and he had a better relationship with people in the Northeast, and he just moved in to solve those issues of temples that were disorganized, getting them, you know, increasing the membership, but also getting people more disciplined in the teachings and understanding the teachings. He was preaching. He became the Northeast region, and Philadelphia was one of the temples. So he started off in Boston. He'd go to Philadelphia, he'd go to Camden, New Jersey, he'd go to New York, but he was constantly during that time from the 50s and early 60s, constantly just traveling between these temples, and Philadelphia is one of them. He also met, we talk about, later in the book, we talk about the Klan chapter, and one of the ministers he actually was minister of Philadelphia, he wasn't the first. But another person who was also minister of Philadelphia was Jeremiah X, also later known as Jeremiah Shabazz. And he was appointed by Elijah Muhammad to take over the Atlanta temple. And it is Malcolm and Jeremiah Shabazz that meet with the Klan in Atlanta. So there's that connection also.
Very interesting. I'm going to share my favorite passage of the book. If you have your book in front of you, you want to go to page 447. And this is the international element of Malcolm's impact across the globe. But one thing that we all, I think, can relate to in life is struggle, is conflict, is being let down, is losing a friendship or a loved one over a difference of opinion. I think every human being can, everyone, whether you're a child or an adult, you can attest to having that experience. And for me, this was profound. And on 447, I'll begin the passage. Before he left Ghana on May 17th, accompanied to the airport by an entourage of officials from friendly embassies, Malcolm experienced a smaller, more personal rejection. The young boxer, Cassius Clay, soon to become Muhammad Ali, one of the world's most famous men, had been Malcolm's friend. In January, when Malcolm was suspended from the nation, but not fully detached from it, Clay was training for his bout against heavyweight champion Sonny Liston. The challenger invited Malcolm, his wife Betty Shabazz, and their three daughters down to Miami. It was said to be the only vacation Malcolm and Betty ever took together. After upsetting Liston and becoming champion at age 22 on February 25th, 1964, the young boxer made his adherence clear to the Nation of Islam and accepted his Muslim name from Elijah Muhammad only days before Malcolm's exile from the nation became permanent. Now, as Malcolm, the NOI apostate, left his hotel on the way to the airport, he crossed paths with Ali, the NOI true believer. Malcolm greeted the younger man, but Ali walked on. Years later, he said that snubbing Malcolm was one of the great regrets of his life. Quote, "I wish I'd been able to tell Malcolm I was sorry, that he was right about so many things," Ali wrote in a memoir published 40 years later. "But he was killed before I got the chance. He was a visionary ahead of all of us," end quote. And that really resonated with me on the level of the impact, again, that we have on each other, you know, as we, as a community. And in this instance, these very historic, impactful Black figures had at times conflict with each other. This was obviously a public conflict, and it was part of a systemic, you know, rejection that Malcolm experienced from the Nation of Islam. And also within this passage to learn that the only vacation that he and Betty and children took was to Miami at that time. And, you know, true public servants serve and serve and serve. And certainly Malcolm X did that, and maybe did not always get to relish, you know, the pleasantries of life. And to learn that was quite compelling, and another tidbit that I certainly wasn't aware and others might not be. So as we segue into questions, Tammy, I'm going to ask you one last thing that I'm sure is on other folks' mind and seeing some of the insights here. And that is that your dad and you working under his tutelage didn't start off on this quest 30 years ago, three decades plus ago, with the intention that you were going to write this compelling work about Malcolm X per se, and what it act in the process, in the journey. But I'm curious if you could share some tips, whether they are journalistic tips or general writing tips or even book publishing tips, because I know many people who are joining us tonight for this discussion are probably thinking in the back of their minds that one day they too might want to write a book, or your book is already in progress, but you don't even know it's going to be a book, or you don't even know you're going to write it yet. So share with us some general tips about this process that you learned, or that helped propel you moving from doing the actual news gathering into the writing and then editing, as well as the book publishing stage.
I think it's important when you're there, understanding that there are different skill sets in writing a book. There's, if you're independent, what kind of book you're writing, but I think that all books that you write are going to require research, self-editing, and writing. And so it's important to understand these are very different skill sets. When you're doing research, whether it's just going to libraries or talking to people and interviewing, and how you interview and how you get people to talk to you, sometimes it's very easy, sometimes it's difficult. You know, that's a type of skill set. And when you're doing these things, separate them. I think that's really important. So like, say if we're talking about, you're doing your research all the time and you're just getting this information and you're gonna do your interviews and that's fine. But that understand that there's a preparation that you have to do for that, whether it's researching who this person is and everything you can find out about them, and also what it is that you want them to tell you and figuring out ways and how you can connect with this person. That's one skill set. Then there's the skill set of, you know, when you're just going through documents, having the patience just to sit down and read whatever research it is that you're reading. That's another skill set. And setting time aside for these different things, because there's a frame of mind that you're in. It's a different energy that goes with these things. Writing, which is a solo effort, you really have to set a different set aside time for that, and it's different. And it requires a different mindset also. And then editing your writing. Do not edit and write at the same time. That you should set aside, you should separate these things. The other thing I also recommend if you're going to write a book is outlines. I was never big on outlines. Just write, right? You know, but outlines are important because they really help you stay focused on what the idea is and help you see how the book is going to shape up. And so when you're talking to people, and even when you want to sell your book idea so that you can get that book contract, you already know how your book is going to end. So that's, an outline is cool. And also understand that outlines change too. So don't worry if your outline looks totally different from, you know, the first time. Dad had like different sets of outlines throughout the process of this book. But even to the last day, he had an outline, you know, and he would change it. You know, sometimes, you know, some of these chapters became unwieldy. You can tell when you read that. For example, the Klan chapter is quite a long chapter. It actually was longer and we had to split it up. So as a, like I said, your outline's gonna change over time. And then even though you have this outline, it helps you just stay focused on what it is that you want your story to be, so you don't bring in, you don't go off on too many tangents and people say, oh, what is this that they're bringing in? And I think that's important even for fiction. You know, what you want your story to be, what's going to be important to telling that story, because in a novel, you can get lost, you know, and because it was good writing, it was a good day, but it could not have any bearing on the story. And you know, you have to, and an outline would help you with that. So those are some tips.
Terrific. That was very helpful. Excited to now bring in some questions from the audience and those listening into the discussion. Cheryl Watkins asks, is this your only collaboration effort with your dad? Do you have other nuggets or other projects stored away that you're working on into the future, and or what's next after this book?
I've been so focused on just getting this book finished and out there. And I also want to take time to say, you know, again, while we wrote this book and we are bringing out a lot about Malcolm's family life, that for us during the process of writing this book, our family was really important. When, you know, my father having me working with him on this and taking on this book was a relief to him in a lot of ways, because I was somebody he could talk to, and we were both had the same interest in making sure that this story would be told and not share the information publicly before we were ready to release it, for example. But family's important. And when my father passed away, I mean, my family was always there and supportive of the book all these years. But when my father passed away, their support has been really important to me in that I was able to commit full time to these last 2 years to making sure that I got my father's voice, you know, preserved in the book and his writing, and just and making sure that, you know, it was accurate. I was dealing with the end notes, all of that. It was a lot. It was a lot to take on, and learning the editing process was also interesting. It was fascinating to me, but being able to have the support of my family to allow me to just focus on that is so important. So I don't want to, you know, not bring that in also. That was also important to the process throughout the working of this book. And as far as working with my dad, I worked with him on different things. I was there when he organized the Monroe Trotter Group, and I helped out with, you know, making sure that they documented their sessions, making sure that they were recorded, and even transcribed a lot of their sessions so that they put out journals that they can still members can still refer to, for because those discussions were about, you know, how to be better columnists, which is a different skill set than being a journalist, and then being Black columnists, and just having these workshops about how to do that and stay true to their opinion and their perspective. And the other thing I want to mention about the Monroe Trotter Group is that they got to meet with two presidents, sitting presidents, President Clinton as well as President Obama. So there are different things that I can work on. I have a lot of options. But you know, right now my focus is just making sure that, you know, now that the book is out, it's not a relief to me because I really just want people to buy it. I want to make sure they're buying it. It's you put a book out, you want it to be read. And this book I feel is so important. My father not being here is very sad for all of us because he would have loved this part of it. He would have loved engaging with the audience and how they're taking in this information. And you know, he would have loved it. And so it's sad, and I focus on that, but I also focus on wanting to make sure that people are receiving it and processing it, you know, and it's important. But yes, I have other stories that I want to work on, and I will work on them, but right now this is what I'm focused on.
Sounds good. Tamara Williams asks about just the process of unpacking and researching this topic, and if you ever found yourself in situations that you found emotionally taxing, and if that had an impact on you. And in some ways, impact can be good. Like, so did that personally motivate you in any way to adopt a different perspective? And also, how heavily were you involved in the research aspect of the work? I think you did touch upon it, but through that process, I think tying that to, did this ever at any point in time not bother you per se, but have an impact that just overwhelmed you? You know, we look at the narrative journalism that's happening this year in particular, particularly around Black men and the stories that we're telling, and they're very overwhelmingly tragic, sad, and just difficult stories to tell as journalists. And to likely have documented Malcolm X at the time of his life would have had certainly provided the capacity for difficult, you know, bridges to cross as a storyteller. And I know your dad had that experience, but as you went through this whole process, did you yourself ever have to pause, you know, emotionally, or did something ever spark change in your perspective?
For me, the focus was always, this is such a unique situation experience. And, you know, in explaining sometimes when people, if I dared share, you know, that I was working on this incredible experience because I was really proud of it and other people didn't receive it. It just made me focus more on just getting the story and saying, well, they'll realize when the story comes out, because you have to focus on doing the work. And working with Dad, I mean, it was just really, I was so much more focused on that experience. And again, it's like, it's a rare situation when you can work with somebody like that, you know, talking with them at all hours of the day and night, and talking about everything. And that's what I really treasured about the experience. And so what may have, yeah, there were incidents that impacted me. I mean, there was a situation I remember, I mentioned this in another interview, where somebody came up to me and they said they understand I'm working on this book about Malcolm. They didn't know me. And they said they didn't like Malcolm. And I said, well, what do you know about him? I mean, it took me a minute to get to that point, by the way. But and I'm like, what do you know about him? And, you know, and just to find out this person is annoying thing, they're going by, you know, what people say and emotions, and they're just not informed. So I don't, that could have impacted me a different way. And, you know, what you learn is that, well, what can you do when people aren't informed if you don't have the information? So you hope that they'll get the information. So I asked them, what do you know about, I picked a year, 1963. Do you know what that was like? And he said, no. And I said, well, let me give you some ideas of what was going on. And then I told him, I said, now with knowing all this is going on, for example, you know, the church bombings, the lynchings, you know, people not being able to get their jobs, the Voters' Rights Act, all of these things are going on, the constant marching. I said, all this is going on. So what do you think is a healthy response to that if you're Black? And they had nothing to say to that. And I said, exactly. You know, you just leave it at that. And you kind of move on to say, okay, I got to focus on getting the story out. And come on, Dad, let's finish the book.
Sounds good. I'm going to try to get through the questions that we see. I'm going to combine a few to that point. What are your thoughts in general, not necessarily that we can cover everyone who's ever written about Malcolm X, but truth be told, there's a lot of literature out there and a lot of narrative stories about Malcolm. And so, again, if maybe we could highlight how your work, your piece of work here kind of changes the conversation. How would you kind of summarize that? How are you adding to the history of Malcolm X and or changing the conversation about what we know?
Not many people in their writing of the books talk to Malcolm or his family in the way that we did. And the other thing is, I mean, during the 90s, a lot of his compatriots, people who were his contemporaries, you know, who worked with him, particularly at the end of his life, you know, they were willing to, I mean, let's understand, when he was assassinated, it was a hot time. You had the assassination, you had the trials. A lot of people went into hiding. A lot of people didn't want to talk about it. It was hard. And it was 1965. There was a lot of stuff going on. And there was crazy times even after that. So quite a few of those people went into hiding. They didn't want to talk about Malcolm for a long time. And then some people did talk about Malcolm. And then when they saw that there was this wave happening where people, there was this renewed interest and they wanted to eat up anything they could find out. A lot of his contemporaries started writing stories about their relationships with them. And it helped us understand what Malcolm was like to them and told us a lot about his contemporaries, but also about that time. But it was also like just that particular experience. It didn't really look at his whole life. It looked at his impact on them in that time. Yes, there are other biographies out there, and I think it's great because Malcolm is important. It shows you that his name keeps coming up, that people keep wanting to write about him, that people want more information about him, shows that he's important to them. So to be able to be a part of this canon is great. And to be able to make a contribution, I mean, there's all these contributions, and some of it you can like, some of it you not like, but you're going to have, there are people I know who aren't going to like this book. So, I mean, there's nothing you can do about it, but it's part of the canon. It raises the conversation about Malcolm, and we're talking about him again.
Great point. I'm going to skip to Eric Ruggert, who asked about the transformation of Malcolm to Malcolm Shabazz. And he points out in comments, and this is probably more of a general comment question, but clearly with your knowledge, you can give us some perspective. He talks about how no one calls Ali, Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay. Yet as a culture or society, we often refer to Malcolm simply as Malcolm X. And so I'd be interested in your perspective on that, because you do get into the later parts of his life and explore that kind of at length. But why is it that we, as a society, we focus on the years of Malcolm X in that as that full identity being focused on that one point in time around his involvement with the Nation of Islam versus looking at the whole man, which is the work that you all have done here? But why is that? And also, why do people not recognize he did transform to Malcolm Shabazz?
Well, I also think that transformation wasn't complete. And we didn't fully experience or see that. And yes, he did convert, and that was the religion. He was very, you know, very committed to Sunni Islam, and that is important. But even he said during those last times that he knows you know, people call him Malcolm X, he's going to continue answering that because he knows that his people aren't free. And until people aren't free, then he'll embrace this, you know, El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, which was about, which represent even more freedom for him. But Malcolm X was, you know, it was representing of the fight that he was still engaged in, even though he was at that time taking it to the international platform, right? And bringing it to the United Nations. And during that last year, he's traveling. He does his Hajj, but he's also traveling into these different countries, some Islamic countries. He went to Iran. He went to the Middle East. He went to Africa. He went all over. He went to Europe and he spoke and he learned and he met people and he was learning about what was going on. And he was learning, you know, he was expanding his knowledge. And then people say, oh, you seem to be more open to, you know, other people's struggles who don't look like you. And he says, well, they have similar struggles. They understand what we're going through in the United States as Black people. And he said, even though they're not Black. But he also was saying that they have to prove who they are to me, you know. And that's even what Wilford was saying to us in his interviews with us. You know, he said that, you know, Malcolm at that time, he was listening. And I would argue that we don't fully get to experience him, you know, fully, you know, in that evolution because he was killed.
And can you go a step further in that? Could we introduce the discussion around race and his, not just his mission in life or his purpose in life and the various impacts that he made in terms of elevating the position of Black America and Black people, but that through this, as we call, we're using the word transformation, but through his life's journey, can you talk a little bit about his impact on everyone and where he was at the end of his life and where his thinking was at that point in time?
Because he was open and he was listening to people and people were, he was in contact with a lot of different people. He was speaking, he was being seen on television, again, how he was able to use television media to his advantage and getting his message across. So he appealed to people. And when he, for example, I think about, and I talk about this in the epilogue, where he was at the University of Beirut in Lebanon at the time, and he said, he's speaking with those students. These are Lebanese students. They're not Americans, they're Lebanese. And this is actually the American university, sorry. So, but one of them who we actually did speak to later, she was telling us about the experience that he was telling them that we had to monetize our resources. And she said, nobody had ever said that to her. And this is in the Middle East, and these are not Black people. So it's like, he's having conversations. He's relatable. He has an enormous curiosity. He has an enormous grasp of what's, he's read a lot. So he has an enormous grasp of what's going on. But then it's like being able to go into these situations and listen to these people and then bring his own experience and understanding how people relate to these things that they may not have considered because they're too close to the situation. As similar as what we experience when people see our situation, we're too close to ours. So
would you describe him as a figure that was embracing of white people and other people of color? How would you, in the research you've done, how would you describe his thinking at the end of his life?
He was listening to people. He was embracing what people were telling him. But again, he would say, they have to prove to me who they are. You know, I haven't made a judgment on them. I'm just listening to their stories and I see similarities. I can have a conversation with them, you know, but he's also says they may betray, you know, he's also very wise to, you know, that there could be a betrayal. And I would like to turn people to the survey that we have, the appendix of this book, which talks where the Islamic Center of Geneva gave him a survey of a few questions, and this was at the end of his life, and he answers their questions. And, you know, there are a couple of things that he talked about that I felt really interesting. And I wanted to put it, because I wanted people to kind of really see where he was at the end. One of the things I thought was always interesting was, you know, the importance of women and educating women. He criticized the Islamic, he was criticizing Islamic countries for not educating those women as much as they should. But one of the questions they had asked him was about race in particular. You know, basically they're saying you've broken away from Elijah Muhammad. You still hold the Black color as a main base and dogma for your drive under the banner of liberation in the United States. How could a man of your spirit, intellect, and worldwide outlook fail to see Islam, its main characteristic from its earliest days as a message of that confirms beyond doubt the ethnological oneness quality of all races, that thus striking at the root of the monstrosity of discrimination. Endless are the texts in the Quran and prophetic sayings to this effect, and nothing would testify to that more than the historic fact that heterogeneous races, nations, and linguistic entities have always mingled peacefully in the homeland. And his answer to this question, this was from the Islamic Center of Geneva. As a Black man, I do feel that my responsibility is to my 22 million fellow Black Americans who suffer these same indignities because of their color as I do. I don't believe my own personal problem is ever solved until the problem solved for all 22 million of us. Much to my dismay, until now, the Muslim world has seemed to ignore the problem of Black American, and most Muslims who come here from the Muslim world have concentrated more effort in trying to convert white Americans than Black Americans. So yes, he's listening. He hasn't walked away. He hasn't turned his back. He embraces Islam, but he also sees its contradictions and its shortcomings, you know, in the way that people are practicing it. And he said like he had an opinion about it, and he stuck to what was important to him, which was the freeing of Black Americans here in America.
Thank you for that insight. I want to share with folks that you're welcome to check the chat, where our host has shared where you can purchase the book, Fox Bookshop. The URL was mentioned in the chat. Feel free to bring it up. And I'd also like to share that, yes, support your local bookshops. Wanted to mention a few in Philadelphia as well, Black-owned bookshops, Uncle Bobby's and Harriet's. There are numerous ways you can get your books online as well, but please support and pick up The Dead Are Arising. As we sunset this conversation, I'm going to try to surface very quickly, Tammy, a few more good, insightful questions, and we will close out. One from Michael Clemens. Were you able to learn anything or explore Malcolm's mother struggles with mental illness, and did that have an effect on Malcolm?
We did not speak to any of the doctors or anything like that, but we were speaking really through the surviving siblings, particularly Wilfred. And so we didn't have a lot of information on, as I said, as far as what exactly her diagnosis was, and except for what they said in the records. We definitely looked at that, but we didn't spend a lot of time working on that. But what they described her situation wasn't so much it was depression as more of she was exhausted. You know, there was enormous pressures during the depression. Money was really hard to come by, and she was struggling. She had 8 children, and she was a single mother. And yes, the older siblings did step in to help out, but it was still a struggle. And so what they said was that she's really tired. If she could just rest, you know, that would be great. You know, she could come back from this. And, you know, and she, you know, that's what they were saying. Maybe you described that today as depression, but that's what they were really describing that back then. So we did not, you know, really expect too much on that.
Thank you. That's good insight. Wanted to go to DK Initials question, and they ask, how did you unearth details about Fard Muhammad?
Yeah. People talked about it. There were people who were on the scene. Fard, you know, he's a historical figure. He had been written about by other historians over the years too, who were looking at the different Muslim groups and what they were looking at is the history of Black groups and religions that came up, you know, and what their purpose were. And so there were stories about Fard in these books. And these books are older. I mean, they're as old as I am, if not older. And, you know, and we know them. It was in, I'm trying to think of one book right now. off the top of my head. I wish I could look at it right now. I can't think of it right now. But I know that this book was read by many people over the years. And then also the FBI documents on him, and then also interviewing people who are on the scene who actually did meet Fard.
Thank you. That's great insight. One of our members of the crowd here, Tamara Williams, has shared that she really appreciated your insights on the book cover and the image of Malcolm, and was curious if there were other images in the book that they resonated, had any particular meaning that stuck out for why they were chosen to be in the book.
I think that you want images of the story that we're trying to tell. I thought, for example, it was really, and Dad thought it was really important to make sure we had the picture of Will Brown's body, you know, being burnt. It's been around, and people have seen it and elsewhere, but it's an important part of the story. To actually see that physically. So yeah, that's one of the pictures that definitely resonates. But I think, you know, I love the pictures of the families that we were able to get and him speaking. But yeah, I mean, that particular picture of Will Brown was also really important and resonating. And the telling of that particular incident in Omaha, which was a couple of years before the Little family moved there, and how it impacted, you know, Omaha, even to the point the Little family still experienced it when they moved there. So that's why it's really important too.
Thank you. Our last question this evening will be a hybrid of two questions, as a matter of fact. One, Laura Elam asks about the impact of this work and will it be incorporated into school systems. Obviously, you're not you're not over the institutions of higher education or even public K-12, but are you open to making this work transferable to school systems? And then Lamont Brown asked about the experiences of Malcolm X after the Hajj and other pivotal moments in his life. And so the question, I think the final question is, how do we take this great experience and journey of a man, and particularly toward the end of his life, and the impact and the change that he not only was experiencing, but was actually bringing to American culture? How can we take that those experiences, in addition to purchasing the book and reading it, help it be the basis for a platform in our education systems?
I think first we have to read the 537 pages of it and process the information in there. And it's a lot. It's a lot in there. And I think that people need to take the time to really understand. This is not something that you're going to read some of these chapters once and that's it. I mean, you're going to go back and say, wait a minute, what happened there? What is really happening here? And seeing the parallels to that. And the thing is, this, even though this is written about Malcolm's life and Malcolm has passed on, those incidents that we were writing even from 100 years ago are very parallel to what's happening now. You know, 100 years ago, you know, they had the Red Summer of 1919. We've had a brutal summer of killings, right? We've had, you know, there was the Spanish flu. We have a pandemic, another pandemic here with COVID. So there are parallels here. And then it's like this rise of the anxiety of racism. Well, it's not that it's gone away, it's always been there. So it also means that we should learn from the mistakes that were made in the past and try to correct this and deal with this and move forward on that. So that's one level of it. As far as it being in schools, obviously that's obvious, open up for discussion. Of course, we want people to read that. Of course, we want students to read that of all levels. But it's, you know, I get it's going to take time, and however that transpires, we're open to figuring out what that means. But right now, I just wish that people would buy the book and read it and really take the time to process it, because I think it's really important, you know, to not just us as Black Americans here, because our history is American history, but it's important to the world. It's important to understanding, you know, again, it's giving a context not just of Malcolm, but of us and how we got to where we are today. So, yes.
With that, do you have any final thoughts that we did not cover that you would like to share?
Just so focused on really just wanting people to read this book and just to, you know, one, listen to what, and this is also an audio book form as well as ebook, so people don't feel that you only have to go about buying the hardcover. But the hardcover, I think it's beautiful, and the pictures and all that is one experience. But we also have a really good audio book too. But as far as final thoughts on this, I just want people to really read it. I mean, that's at the end of the day. And then let's convene again and talk about what's in here and start processing it and move forward with that. And talk about different ways that we can incorporate this into curriculums and other ways.
So Nathan McCall, author of Makes Me Wanna Holler, A Young Black Man in America, called this book a quote, gripping read. Annette Gordon Reed of Harvard University says this work is an indispensable depiction of the life of Malcolm X. Yehuru Williams of the Boston Globe wrote, this new biography, The Dead Are Rising, humanizes Malcolm X without diminishing him, and that Malcolm's youth adds a new dimension to Malcolm's less familiar origin story. And lastly, to note, Michael P. Jeffries of the New York Times wrote, a new life of Malcolm X is brimming with detail, insight, and feeling. So with that, I wanted to thank Tamara Payne for her time this evening, and thank you all for joining us. Please, please, please take some time to purchase The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X. And until next time, enjoy it, and we look forward to having future conversations on such great bodies of work. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.